years ago, during about 2 days of coaching, a bunch of clients, probably about nine of them, I realized a common theme to their situations. At the end of the second day, it's like, all of them were essentially saying they were not enough. And when I write that and when I speak it, I'm really seeing and thinking those words with capital first letters, capital N-O-T, capital E-N-O-U-G-H, not enough. So their statements were varied. You know, they didn't say the same things exactly. They all added a different word in between those two words, not and enough. I heard not smart enough, not educated enough, not tall enough, not big enough, not strong enough, not slim enough, not thin enough, not good enough, not pretty enough, not handsome enough, not attractive enough, not rich enough, etc. They were not enough. That phrase, not enough, can only be applied by us if we compare ourselves to something else. If as a child we try to reach for, let's say, a container of milk on the higher shelf in the refrigerator, but we can't reach it, we can say to ourselves, I'm not tall enough. Well, we might have said, the milk shelf or the shelf that the milk is on is too high. But because human beings tend to make everything about themselves, not shelves, that statement about the shelf probably didn't happen. It would have been about us. There's a point of view that people do everything they do. They do everything to be okay. We want to feel okay. We want to be told we are okay. We want to see evidence that supports the idea that we're okay. But when we feel we're not blank enough, we feel that we are not okay. Most of us feel that to some degree, maybe to a high degree. That is not an unusual thing for people to be feeling. So, how do we decide we are enough? How do we decide we are okay? Well, I think it's the same way we decide that we're not enough and we're not okay. We compare ourselves to other people and to situations in which we have expectations. In the context of running, this is having a foot race, right? We're going to go run on a playground field or run around a track or something. If we say we are not fast enough, we must be comparing ourselves to either other people who are running or some accepted standard of foot speed. If we compare ourselves to a clock, you know, the stopwatch that maybe somebody is holding in their hand as they're measuring how fast we're running, not fast enough, not fast enough, not enough, not enough, not enough. As a child, we begin to develop a sense of our identity, and the way we do it is by comparing ourselves to other things. Is the crib me? Are these clothes me? Is the mattress in the crib me? Is the wall me? Or so on. We can pretty quickly learn that I'm not a chair, I'm not a wall, I'm not a car, and I'm not a lot of other objects. But it does learn when it starts to see people with similar, I'll say, shapes and forms that, even though I'm not the same size as these other people outside of the crib, I, in fact, am similar to them. Maybe I'm not the same size, but and maybe that's what I do. Maybe this is what we do as children, right? They're bigger. I'm smaller. They're more than. I'm less than. And that's how we identify ourselves and start to create our identity inside the crib and the playpen and compare. comparing ourselves to those people that are outside the crib and the playpen. Before long, that child probably recognized, I'm not old enough and I'm not big enough to be on the other side of the crib or the playpen. That's why I'm in here. Maybe there's something else that indicates I'm less than, besides my age and my size. I think a fundamental problem in human relationships, particularly family relationships, of course, this is where we learn so much about who we are. Well, let me say that differently. It's not where we learn who we are. It's where we create our identities, and then we start to believe that's who we are. But here's where some of the conflicts come, in my opinion, is early on, this topic happens. Oh, I get it. This is about control. The issue is control. And a small child, early on, can interpret its experiences and conclude, I do not have enough control. They, these big people, the people outside the crib, parents, whomever, babysitters, siblings, they have all the control. I would say when that conclusion is reached, that's when the battle for control begins in earnest. For people who appreciate American football, you could say control, that idea, that energy pattern of control, is like a football. It's like the football that the two teams, the child and others, start to battle for. I want that ball. I want that ball. I want that ball. I want control. I want control. And that's where the battle comes, intensifies. You don't have to wait too long because people go, oh, well, this is the terrible twos and terrible threes. What's going on? I'll tell you what's going on. There's a battle for control. Battle for control. That child is trying to assert itself. And it doesn't know what it can and cannot control, but it, frankly, is interested in controlling everything it possibly can. And if parents mismanage that relationship with children, gee, I wonder if that's ever occurred. But if they mismanage that relationship and then have to resort to their size and their strength and their power, and because I said so, because I'm the father, because I'm the mother, I said so. That's how they control small children. And it's just a matter of time before that backfires. When those children who are controlled by those kind of efforts become adolescents, that's when the tide can change. And it often does. And when you read stories about teenagers and young adults abusing their parents, you go, yeah, and older people abusing their parents, like, wow, what is that about? What it's about is that battle for control is still going on, and it's out of hand. It's out of control when people get hurt. If not enoughness, if not okayness, is measured only by control over other people, we're going to have disastrous relationships with other people. And if they haven't already occurred, they are on the way. This idea, and this is the talk today, is trying to outrun less than. Trying to outrun that feeling of being less than. Less than presupposes less than another person, less than another thing. And as we're establishing our identities, we use other people for the purposes of comparison. Who would we have compared ourselves to as we were very small children? Who would that have been? That will say a lot about what our current experiences are, our current conditions are, and where healing needs to occur. Now, in most cases, a child will compare themselves to siblings, parents, other adults, aunts, uncles, grandparents, whomever is in that environment, and peers, other little children. They can pick up on the energy in their family of origin. It's like a soup that we're in. And while adults may overlook it, you know, the feelings of hostility or fear or you name it, in the home, children are getting it. They're in the soup and they're receiving it. That's penetrating their consciousness. They are absorbing it like little sponges. Bruce Lipton says until we're about 6 years old, we are absorbing everything directly into our subconscious minds because we have no filtration system. We have no way to, that doesn't belong to me. That doesn't make any sense. That's their behavior. That's their problem. That's not about me. If we don't have that capability, it's about me, 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 and we take it all in. You can imagine this if you look at some families, that the message that they're taught is not less than, it's more than. We are more than fill in the blank. You can see this kind of concept showing up in people who believe that they're elite, they're special, they're above and beyond anybody else. You can also see it in racists. And you can see some of these behaviors that indicate a complete lack of understanding of the human condition, except for their own privileged state. That lack of compassion, the lack of understanding that there's a need for justice and fairness. Hey, you think you could see that in politics today in America? It's like, yeah. It makes you wonder how these people can't notice the suffering in the family of man. What are they noticing if they're not noticing that? They can't be noticing much. The problem with more than as a concept is that it is basically the same as less than. They're two sides to the coin, and they're not true. Neither one of those is true. We're not more than, and we're not less than. They're lies. Do we believe them? Sure, we believe them. Do we act like they're true? Sure, we act like they're true. But both of them require tremendous energy to sustain. If you want to hold on to, I'm more than, I'm more than, I'm more than, that is more than a full-time job. Just to be able to block out evidence to the contrary and to reinforce that, to keep that belief alive as if it were true. And it takes tremendous energy trying to overcome the feeling of less than, because we're constantly trying to outrun it. But if we even accept it, what we've done is we think we've turned the engine of our desires off, of our potential off, of our need to grow off. We have not. We have turned ourselves into a powder keg, into an IED, improvised explosive device, because we're denying the natural get into balance activity of our consciousness. Both of those, more than, less than, are lies. And you can't have one without the other, because they are the opposite sides of the coin. But on a soul level, on the true level, we all have our origins in the same energy. We all have our source of being is the same, divine consciousness. That's our energetic parentage is identical, no matter where we are on the planet, no matter where we go to school, no matter where we're born, no matter what our color is, the language we speak, or the religion we're brought up in, we are equal. But on the ego level, not the soul level, but on the ego level, we do all that we can to avoid the pain that we attach to the feelings of, I don't want to feel less than, I don't want to feel less than, I don't want to be not okay, I don't want to be not okay. And we run from that boogeyman until we realize it doesn't really exist. And for some people, they run their entire lives until they fall over physically dead. So how do we react to our own perceptions of less than? Christ in Christ Returns reveals startling truth. Says that depending on the consciousness of a person might fight that feeling, push against that feeling, and the situations that led them to feel that way. Or they may succumb to it, give up, go into despair. There's nothing I can do about it. Fight or flight, anger or docility, battling or quitting. Some years ago, I had a client to call me. I think she was from Wyoming, way up there, about 48 years old. She said, I need help. I've got real difficulties with authority figures. You know, I find myself battling it all the time. And so in a short period of time, we arrived at this set of images. She was the fourth child in a family, fourth and final one. She's in a crib. Her three older siblings, only older by several years each, were outside of the crib, and they were going to go riding on their ponies. But she wasn't. Because she was a little girl, 2 years old or so, stay in the crib, sweetie, guys, stay in the crib. Let me out. She was battling. She was fighting. That feeling that she got of being less than, because her siblings, her brothers and sister, were going to go riding on ponies. And she wasn't. She wasn't going to be allowed to do that because she was too little, too young, too small. She was less than. She battled. And her siblings went riding on ponies, and she didn't. 40-some years later, don't tell me what I can't do and can do. Don't you? It's like, I'm your boss. You can't tell me what I can do and can't do. And I'm. She was been battling that ever since. She'd been fighting against that projection that she couldn't do something because she was less than. Marianne and I have a friend. It was originally her friend. He's now my friend as well. He's an amazing guy. I think he's about 86 years old now, maybe a little older. He lives in Washington State. Every year or 2 years, he comes and visits us for a couple of weeks. Very interesting guy. He was a chief communicator for about 22 years on Air Force One, 5 different presidents. Amazing stories. Van, that's his first name, Van is very physically intelligent. I noticed that. I said something about a hula hoop. He said, I never tried it. I said, I'm struggling making a hula hoop work. He comes back in from the garage. He said, I did it. I did it 14 times. I said, I did it 14 times too. You know, one revolution each time. He said, no, I did it. 14 revolutions one time. I said, wow. So he told me about how physically intelligent he was. Not in those terms. He didn't use phrases like that. But he would tell me how he was a roller skater and a ice skater and a skier and stuff. I believe this to be true, that the ability to draw is a requirement or it hinges upon physical intelligence. And this is what I mean. I have a pen in my hand or a pencil. I need to be able to have an image in my mind and make it come out of the pencil in my hand. I need to be able to get my hand to intelligently make marks on a piece of paper or a canvas, and then I'll go, oh, nice picture. So I said to Van, I would like you to draw something for me. No. No, Van, just here. Just draw a picture of, I'll show you a picture of a dog. Just draw it. No. Van, what's going on? Just do humor me. I'm trying to prove a concept. No. I said, what is going on? He said, my sisters can draw. I can't draw. This is an 84 or 5-year-old guy at this time. I'm going, your sisters are dead. I said, yeah, but they could draw. They could do shading. They could do pastels and stuff. He had two older sisters by a couple of years, and he's now describing a scene from early childhood in which he concluded he was less than, relative to artistic ability, than they were. He made that conclusion, end of story, that's it. Nothing else he could do about that. It's like, wow. No amount of coaxing, cajoling, pleading with him could get him to draw something for me. I found that to be amazing. He told me he was a skier, and after he retired from the military, he was skiing, and then he noticed some little kid was racing him. Unbeknownst to Van, he just noticed this kid was kind of paralleling down the slope, and finally he said, are you racing me? And the little kid said, yeah, about 10 years old. He said, okay, well, come on, let's race. They raced. The kid beat Van, who at this point was, I'm guessing, 40-some, you know, maybe 50 years old. The kid won. Van said he went home, put his skis away, and never skied again. I found that to be sad, those two stories. But then I flashed back earlier, just recently, actually, that my three older sisters were practicing new dances, rock and roll kind of dances, in the kitchen when I was a little kid. So here I am, 8-year-old boy with three older sisters, 17, 14, 13. You think I might be outmatched when it comes to learning how to do a rock and roll dance? I'm still trying to figure out sisters, which is my left foot again? Which is my right foot? And they're doing these dances, and they're spinning and doing this stuff like that. I did what Van did. My sisters have this talent. I don't have this talent. End of story. Boom. I made that decision at 8 years old that I was less than my sisters in terms of dancing. Like, wow. Giving up is taught to children, either by other people or by ourselves. You can take what Van imaged and what I imaged and go, boom, that's all she wrote. No, it's not all she wrote. But if we get taught that, if our educational system teaches that, and it does, it labels us intelligent or less than intelligent, as talented or less than talented, as obedient or less than obedient, as good or less than good, as athletic or less than athletic, or musical or less than musical, or pretty or handsome or less than pretty or handsome, worthy or less than worthy, as having a lot of potential or having less potential than fill in the blank. And that list of labels and messages that we incorporate into our identities can go on and on. Oh, I'm not a good singer, musician, with math, with English, with tests, with languages, with sports, with girls, with boys, etc., etc. All of those come from that labeling process that mold and shape us into less than we are, less than we could be. If you have brothers, particularly older brothers, and you're a boy, you would have compared yourself to your brothers. Younger brothers would have compared themselves to their older brothers. If you have sisters and you're a girl, you would have compared yourself to your sisters, and they would have compared themselves to you. We would have compared, as boys, ourselves to our parents, particularly our fathers, and girls would have compared themselves to their parents, particularly their mothers. There's another important word in this conversation about trying to outrun less than, and it begins with a C-O-M, just like comparing, but the word is competing. Competing. Humans, driven by egos, are going to compete with other people for energy, for attention, for survival, to arrive first in the race of life. But all living beings do this. Have you ever heard of this expression? The runt of the litter? The runt of the litter, usually applied to a puppy or a kitten. The runt is the runt because, competitively speaking, it is less than its siblings. So it didn't get the nourishment, didn't get the energy, didn't get the attention that the stronger, more competitive, perhaps more ruthless siblings got. Here's what we can do to overcome our miseducation that led to this less than identity. And this is probably the solution to all problems. Get more information. Get more knowledge so we can access new viewpoints about ourselves, about others, and what happened in our experiences. Not what we made up about what happened, but what actually happened, factually. You know, falling off a tricycle, factually, is falling off a tricycle. Period. End of story. There's nothing else to be added factually. But we make up stuff about we're less than, we're not as agile as, we're clumsier than, and on and on and on and on. Even though the ego's driving us will say to us that more than and better than are the real goals to all of our activities, we can know something else. We can discover something else is true. And that something else is equality, which leads to respect of ourselves and respect of other people's. Not getting over, not getting ahead, not getting behind, and not getting screwed by others. Just being equal. Being equal. Equal but different. Equal but different. That's reality. Here's a point of view or information that might help as we, I'll say, heal some of this less than, more than toxicity that we've acquired. In studies of American and Japanese educational systems, this very distinct pattern was discovered. In American schools, if a child didn't get the correct answer to a question immediately, that child was considered less than the others. The ones who got it immediately were considered more than. You go, is it any wonder that kids shrink when the teachers ask questions in the classroom? They try to become invisible? In Japan, to the contrary, children who didn't get the correct answer immediately were encouraged by the teachers and classmates to continue trying to get the answer by diligent effort, by being persistent, by being persevering, trying to understand the principles behind this problem-solving process. And until they got it. That's a huge difference. That's a huge difference. It's like saying to somebody, can you imagine saying this to a kid in kindergarten, even in preschool nowadays? If you don't have the skill at the very beginning, you're screwed because you're less than. Like, but this is day one. Yeah, I know. That's how it is. That's just how it is. That's unbelievable. Look how kids in America were judged according to IQ tests created by people who do well on IQ tests. So they changed the game, they changed the scoring, they changed the playing field, because that's what they do well at. And it's like, that's the only intelligence, IQ, that's the only way to measure a kid, his worth, his value, his, over the years, that's changed somewhat. We recognize there are others, 6 or 7 or 8 more intelligences. But back in the day, that's it. And we labeled, classified, categorized people, made them throwaways or considered them more than. Those two groups, less than, more than. Bad news. In Japan, the value of persevering, the value of being persistent is taught and honored. There are fables in America. They're not written by Americans, but we still popularize them to a certain extent, which is to my way of thinking. We pay lip service to this idea by reciting the story of the tortoise and the hare, right? Just because you're first off the line, just because you're the quickest off the line, doesn't really mean you're going to win the race, because that tortoise, you know, persistence, keep plodding along, wins in that particular case. I don't think we really believe that. We pay lip service to it. We don't believe it, because we will diminish that tortoise. That person's slow. They are less than. Their intelligence is less than. Their aptitude is less than. If we've had incidents similar to the American version that I referred to a little while ago, you're less than because you didn't have all the answers when you started kindergarten. It's like, wait a minute. We can heal those faulty images. Those faulty images, even though we've used them to create our identity, we were like, oh, this is true about me, this is true about me, this is true about me, and we construct our identity that way. We're in a position where we can do something about it. We need to rethink this idea of natural talent. Does it even exist? I think we need to cut ourselves some slack. We cut ourselves some slack, then we can start to play at, or if you want, work at, developing any talent that interests you. What is a natural talent? Is there even such a thing? Is it such a thing? I don't know. When I was thinking about this, I said, heck, we have to be slapped on the ass when we're born just to get our breathing started. We don't even know how to breathe. Breathing is not natural to a newborn unless it's whacked on the butt. Toilet training. That's not natural. We were doing something that was natural, and parents like, this is objectionable. I don't like this. We got to teach this kid something else. And they started. They started our training. And guess what? They didn't stop, and neither did we, until we mastered that control over these bodily functions. You mean to tell me toilet training is not natural? Not from some of the stories I hear about people in their toilet training. I'm going to believe in natural talents as soon as this scenario occurs. Here, imagine this. A newborn baby just comes into the world, and it's whisked away by a nurse. 30 minutes later, that nurse returns to the mother, a big smile on her face, said, your child is a natural. She's playing a piano, she's talking in 2 languages, and she's writing a novel while she's watching TV and learning recipes on Food Channel. Man, she certainly is a natural. Guess what? That's not happening. That's not happening. That natural is not happening. Everything is learned. Everything is learned or mislearned. And everything takes as long as it takes to learn. Using other people as a measuring stick, you know, well, he learned it in this amount of time, and he ran this fast in this amount of time, and he wrote his novel in this amount of time, and he grew this tall in this amount of time, gives false readings. It gives false readings of less than and more than. We're interfering with ourselves by using that faulty measurement. Problematically, the condition of less than is marketed. It's the first step in selling stuff. If I can convince you that less than exists, then good luck. Oh, boy, you are really, really lucky because I have the solution. I can make you more than. Really, really, God, could I buy it? Could I buy it? That's what advertisers are doing. They're projecting these images, these consciousness forms, that you are less than. And the good news is, I have a way for you to be more than. You want to buy it? You want to buy it? Ask your doctor. Run to the dealership. Run to the store. Run to this phone number and dial 1-800-whatever. They want to sell you stuff. They want to sell you stuff. Now, some problems can be solved by addition. Let's add the product. Let's add something. Let's add something. We can add stuff to overcome a problem condition. If you or I were to run out of gas in our car, guess what? Adding gas is a good idea. That's an excellent solution to the problem, addition. Sometimes problems are better handled by subtraction. Got a nail in a tire that's flat? Well, I think maybe instead of just adding air, you might want to subtract the nail. Subtract the nail. And if you want to, and you need to, add air. Got erroneous beliefs in your subconscious, in your consciousness? Got faulty bricks in your identity? Faulty images about yourself and people and life and what's possible and God? Subtract them. Subtract them. They can be removed. They can be dissolved. They can be transformed. We are equal to the task of becoming aware of who and what we really are and what we are capable of. We're equal to it. We are equal to it. We can get off the seesaw of less than, more than, less than, more than, less than, more than, less than, more than. That produces tremendous fear and anxiety and anger and despair in our lives. We can be equal to knowing the truth. I would like to end the service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our help, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal, loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. we commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.